May it please the court, my name is Kylie Dunn, registration number 40638, and I represent Ms. Palumbo. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, and I'd like to focus my argument on the first issue in the opening brief, which is whether the prosecutor's use of Ms. Palumbo's silence, both to impeach her testimony and as substantive evidence of her guilt, was improper and it's reversible error. This is a case where a testifying defendant was impeached with her general silence prior to trial. She was impeached with the fact that she didn't come forward and give the police a full account of what happened. This is not a case where a defendant was subjected to targeted impeachment with specific omissions and specific statements that she made prior to trial. The prosecutor said, "The first time you told this story about Steve Palumbo attempting to kill you was yesterday at 3 o'clock. He said, "You didn't tell the police that you were the victim of an attempted murder, did you? You didn't tell the police that he tried to kill you, did you?" And he also said, "So for 8 months, you held on to this story." Briefly, the relevant facts are these. Ms. Palumbo shot Mr. Palumbo on May 7th. She went to the hospital immediately thereafter for her injuries. There was a deputy in the ambulance with her, and she was guarded by deputies at the hospital. And according to the record, she was formally arrested at 11 p.m. that evening on May 7th. The record does not indicate whether she was given Miranda warnings at the time of her arrest. However, on May 11th, she appeared in court for her initial advisement, and at that time, she was advised of her rights, which pursuant to Rule 5 includes her right to remain silent. In the ambulance, Ms. Palumbo said, yes, she had been drinking, and she said that she knew she had fired a gun, which is when they were swabbing her hands for gunshot residue. And at the hospital, she made a limited statement to a police officer that she had just been shooting at the walls, trying to get him to stay away from her. The prosecutor didn't impeach Ms. Palumbo just with omissions from prior statements. He impeached her with the fact that she had remained silent up until the time of trial, which she was entitled to do under the Constitution. Her statements that she made at the hospital were entirely consistent with her testimony at trial. She gave a complete account of what happened when she testified. She testified that she had gone down to the basement and shot 4 bullets into the walls. And she testified that she had shot Mr. Palumbo, in an effort to get him to stay away from her. I think, therefore, this case is very similar to People v. Hardaway, which is a case that the people cited in their answer brief. In that case, the defendant made 2 brief statements at the time that she was arrested. Her testimony at trial was an elaboration on those initial statements. And then she was impeached with her failure to give a more complete statement at the time of her arrest the court held that impeachment was improper because the defendant's more elaborate trial testimony merely augmented her initial statement. And therefore, the details that were omitted from her prior statement were not sufficiently inconsistent to be admitted for impeachment purposes. The Hardaway court noted that it's well settled that a prosecutor cannot legitimately impeach the defendant on her failure to make further statements after she's invoked her right to remain silent.
All statements made prior to the Miranda warning or after the Miranda warning? The ones that were used to impeach?
Here in this case.
No, Hardaway.
Oh, in Hardaway. In Hardaway, she made those statements immediately after she was advised of her right to remain silent. And the court held that, the fact that she had volunteered some statements didn't mean that she wavered her further right to remain silent thereafter. And I think importantly, Ms. Palumbo was impeached with her general silence, the fact that for 8 months she had not come forward and given the police a full account. I think,
just out of curiosity,
yes.
Was a Rule 16 notice filed here advising the prosecution that she was going to assert self-defense?
Notifying him that she was...
Notifying the prosecution of Rule 16, I think it's B or C, that the defense was self-defense.
I am not sure.
The prosecution knew when the case started that self-defense was going to be a defense, or did they not?
I would assume so. I would have to assume that that notification...
Isn't that why they called Miss, I believe it's Miss Ulibarri, as one of their first witnesses to testify about the events in the cell? And the what they would describe as a concoction of a self-defense theory?
That may well have been why they called Ms. Ulibarri. That was, I mean, she testified about conversations at the jail. I think, though, she was not impeached with omissions of anything she made, statements that she made. Ms. Palumbo was not impeached with omissions of anything that she said at the jail or in the ambulance. She was impeached with just the fact that she had not come forward and told this full story of what happened prior to trial.
What I'm suggesting is that she didn't exactly remain silent because she apparently did talk to Mrs. Ulibarri about her, quote, defense, close quote. And she could have been impeached with those statements, couldn't she?
Perhaps she could have been impeached with what she did not tell Ms. Ulibarri, but she was not impeached with that. She was impeached with just, I mean, his questions were, so for 8 months you held on to this story. I think that a testifying defendant can be impeached with just general pretrial silence when that silence in and of itself is inconsistent with something she testified to at trial. So if she had said, I cooperated with police throughout the investigation, or if she had said, I made a full statement, then of course she could be impeached with the fact that she did not make a full statement. And that's really what happened in People v. Davis, which is a 2010 case. There the defendant testified he had told the detective everything, and so he opened himself up to attack that indeed he had not told the detective everything, but that's not what happened here.
I ask you a question about the standard of review here.
Yes.
Because the briefs seem to be going at cross purposes.
Okay.
First of all, what are the facts? And as I understand your argument on appeal, it's that the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment rights to remain silent were violated. You're making a constitutional argument.
Yes.
So my first question is whether that the constitutional objection was made at trial.
Okay.
And then, depending on what the answer to that question is, if we were to find that there was error in admission of this testimony, what's the standard of review for reversal?
Okay. I believe that the constitutional error, when talking about the impeachment error specifically, I believe that was preserved by counsel's objection after the very first question that the prosecutor asked, which was, the first time you told this story was yesterday. Counsel objected and said, objection, she had no obligation to make statements to anyone.
Okay, so if that's the case, then what's the standard of review? Is it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
I think it should be, constitutional, harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, that unless this court is confident beyond a reasonable doubt that that testimony did not affect the jury's verdict, then you should reverse.
Thank you.
Okay. If the court disagrees that that preserved the constitutional error, then I think plain error review applies, and I think there's a lot of precedent for applying plain error review to this type of trial error.
But under no circumstances are you claiming that this was structural error?
I have not argued that this was structural error.
Okay.
I also want to touch briefly on, I think that in the course of his cross-examination, the prosecutor did reference specifically supposed omissions from her statement at the hospital. And my position is that you cannot separate that part of his cross-examination from his general cross-examination. He bracketed those more specific questions with the general questions that I read to you earlier. And I think that it's very difficult to parse a cross-examination into acceptable parts and unacceptable parts. In Anderson versus Charles, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case, they found that they had to consider the colloquy as a whole, what the general point of the prosecutor's cross-examination was in determining whether an error occurred. And there they found that the general thrust of his cross-examination was proper, that he had enough proper questions in there. But I believe that here it's the opposite. The general point of his cross-examination is clearly to impeach her with her failure to come forward prior to trial. And I think that can be seen especially looking at his rebuttal closing argument in which he said, folks, if the story is on May 7th, I was strangled within an inch of my life. One might think one would send that to the Denver Post and everybody would be reading it. He was clearly using the fact that she had not come forward before trial to impeach her. And furthermore, to whatever extent, this court would find that there were omissions in that statement, I think that any omissions lack any probative value given the circumstances under which that limited statement was made at the hospital. She was under medication. She was in and out of consciousness. It was clearly a custodial setting, regardless of whether she made that specific statement before or after her formal arrest. She was guarded by deputies in the ambulance and at the hospital. And I think People v. Quintana gives a good discussion of why the failure to say certain things in that kind of atmosphere is not probative. And if there's no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. You've got about 3 minutes and 40 seconds.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Susan Friedman, registration number 34450. I represent the people in this matter. I would like to respond to the argument about admission of the defendant's silence, but I have a clarification I'd like to make first, if that's okay. One of the issues here was whether the district attorney misstated the law in closing argument when he said, essentially told the jury, you need not consider the element, the mens rea element for attempted first degree murder because the defendant has pled self-defense, that essentially admits mens rea. And I was not the attorney who prepared the brief below. And when I prepared for this argument and reading the record, I read it differently than she did. I think it's a fair characterization of the DA's argument that he did say self-defense would admit that element, and I think that's incorrect. But
where does that take you?
That takes me to harmless error. It's harmless because factually, no one contested after deliberation or with intent here. I'm not saying it was legally uncontested or that it was a stipulation was made to it, but if you look at the argument, and that's the most important thing, I think, for deciding all of these questions is closing argument. It's about 48 pages long, and that's what I would use in deciding most of these issues. I went back to it over and over again. I would just recommend that. But if you read defense counsel's argument, you find that he admits that she shot him. You know, they're not disputing that. That wasn't what they were talking about. There wasn't a discussion. They didn't argue. She didn't do it with intent, or it was only knowingly. It was just, yeah, well, you heard the people's evidence, and they proved that she shot him. Great. Congratulations, people. We're admitting that. What's really at issue is, was it self-defense? And he goes to that time and time and time again. So it really wasn't a focus. It wasn't such as in McBride, and I realize that's a different issue. That was using the analogy to the yellow light, but we do have that issue here, too. They noted in McBride that after deliberation and with intent were the central focus of the trial, and that's why that was plain error. So here it really wasn't the focus. I mean, it wasn't conceded in a technical legal sense, but it was factually undisputed by the defense, and I don't think that it led the jury to convict her for an improper purpose. I think the entire argument was focused on, was it self-defense? There was no lesser for attempted second degree or anything like that.
Self-defense with deliberation. That's what you're saying.
I think that's sort of what the DA was arguing, but It just sort of went...
You have to prove deliberation here.
Oh, absolutely. And
when the DA said that to the jury, oh, she conceded deliberation.
Right.
And that's, you now say that's a mistake.
Well, pardon?
And you now say that's a mistake?
Yes.
But you say that's harmless error?
Well, we had three objections on the grounds of burden shifting by the defense. So the trial court instructed the jury three separate times about who had the burden to prove what. Not specifically on after deliberation, because like I said, no one talked about it other than that bit of paragraph or so. And then we had counsel mentioned it four times in the 48 pages, talking about the prosecutor's burden of proof, and the jury was properly instructed on the prosecutor's burden of proof, and we presume they followed the directions. So I just think under these facts, though it's error, it doesn't require a reversal, especially because it wasn't objected to. I said harmless error in the beginning, but actually, you know, this wasn't a passing comment. The DA did make the argument, which is why I would, you know, disagree with our answer brief slightly. I think the argument was made, and the fact that defense counsel didn't see fit to object, I think is telling.
So I appreciate your clarification on that. Let's move to the to the Fifth Amendment issue.
Great.
And can you start out by telling me whether you agree or disagree with defendant's counsel on the preservation and standard of review issues? Was the constitutional argument properly objected to at trial? First of all, what's your position on that? And then depending on where you come out on that, what's your position on, if we were to find error, what the standard is that we should apply?
Okay. In the case in chief, nothing was objected to. So plain error applies there. And I think that's conceded in the opening brief and the reply. So we have the case in chief silence, which was what she didn't say at the hospital.
Which was prior to the Miranda advisement, correct?
As far as we know, we know that those deputies didn't ask her any questions, so it seems logical to presume they didn't advise her. They didn't testify about her statements, so later she did make statements in the hospital to other officers, but they didn't testify to that in case in chief, so I don't think it came up. One thing that was interesting I found in reading the motions hearing transcript, I think that was in December, originally the defendant had filed a motion to suppress her statements at the hospital and in the ambulance, and that motion was withdrawn at the hearing, and defense counsel said, I withdraw the motion because I believe these statements actually are exculpatory. And just to clarify for the record, these are the statements I'm aware of. And then he read the statements and he made a comment about how the statements that were made at the hospital, according to discovery, were given after Miranda advisements. So to the extent that that could control, I mean, that's not evidence before the jury, but I did find that in the record. Otherwise, we don't know. But my position on the case in chief is very simple. It's unpreserved, it's plain error review, and under Fletcher versus Weir and Jenkins v. Anderson, pre-advisement silence doesn't violate the Fifth Amendment.
Okay, so let's move on, counsel, to post-advisement silence.
Okay.
Are you contesting that by talking about the defendant's silence up until the day of trial, that the prosecutor was referring to her post-advisement silence?
I am, in that there was not silence, because at the hospital she gave statements, and when the DA cross-examined her, it was very targeted. I would disagree that with the untargeted comment. It's, you said this at the hospital, but you didn't say that. You said this, but you didn't say that. You said this, but you didn't say that. That's exactly how omissions are to be used, when the defendant waives her right to silence and gives a statement. So we have a waiver here because statements were given. Assuming that the motions hearing is correct and we had a Miranda at the hospital, and that's, defendant argues that this is all post-advisement, the failure to give the statements at the hospital, she had already waived her right to silence, so we don't have a Fifth Amendment problem with that.
So, talking about the question that was posed to her at trial was, This is the first time they're telling this story about the victim attempting to kill you was yesterday at 3 o'clock, 3:30.
Yes.
That refers to up to the date of trial, correct?
Yes.
So that's referring to post-advisement silence after she went to court and the court advised her of her rights, correct?
Yes, to some extent it does.
Yes.
Although, okay.
So it certainly does, at least to some extent. So,
yes.
Forgetting about all of her pre-advisement, whatever she said or didn't say pre-advisement, would you agree that the prosecutor was referring to her post-advisement silence, impeaching her on that, and then again highlighting it to the jury in closing argument?
Well,
when he again referred to up until yesterday at 3:30.
Okay. I would disagree. Quickly, I just wanted to say that I do agree that it's preserved in the cross-examination, that it's constitutional error, that it would be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I think that the reason that post-advisement silence is inadmissible for all purposes under Doyle v. Ohio is that the government has induced the silence. Now, I'm not sure that we can say that the government prevented her from telling the Denver Post, or the government prevented her from telling her friends and family. If you look at the closing argument, the DA doesn't talk about how she doesn't tell police. He says, for 8 months, the case is going on. Not a single person called the detective. And this is just in a paragraph talking about her family supporting her. And yet her family doesn't say anything about this domestic violence you've heard so much about. They don't say anything about he's the violent one. I mean, that was sort of the prosecutor's point. So we don't, her story is he tried to kill her, and that's what prompted the shooting. And he's saying, wow, nobody mentioned this at all. So it's not even strictly the defendant didn't mention it, and it's not the defendant didn't go to police, or when questioned, the defendant chose not to tell police, all of which would implicate the Fifth Amendment.
But in his closing argument, the prosecutor said, how do we decide her credibility? Somebody who, according to her, was almost murdered on the evening of May 7th and doesn't say a word about it until 3:30 yesterday. He's implying she should have gone to the police and told, or to somebody and told this story. How does that not implicate her post-advisement silence and violate her rights?
Well, to the extent that you can interpret it as the police, then it would. But if in the context of the entire closing argument, it wasn't focused on telling police. The only people he talked about who didn't tell police is the family. And the family doesn't have a Fifth Amendment right not to tell police that they know there's a history of domestic violence. It was saying she talks to her mom, she talks to her sister, she never says a word. That it came up that way over and over again. She never told a family, her family never told police. We never heard about it. Although she did testify that she told her attorneys.
Do you have any cases that make that kind of fine distinction? Because it seems to me, you know, first of all, at some point the police give her a Miranda advisement, and then she goes to court, and the court tells her again, why isn't that the government telling her, you know, you don't have to say anything to anybody. You can be quiet. Isn't that the fundamental core of what a Fifth Amendment right is?
Yes, but it's not self-executing. And there's no evidence here that she invoked her right to silence. That's the problem.
When you say it's not self-executing, what do you mean, counsel?
In that it's not, the Fifth Amendment by itself doesn't just create a general right to silence. It protects you from having a compelled statement. So if you're in custody where there's inherent compulsion and they're interrogating you within what that means, it protects you. But you have to invoke. We just had the recent Supreme Court case where being silent wasn't enough to invoke. You have to expressly invoke. I don't know that we have that.
So you're saying that in order for her rights to have been protected here, to prevent what the prosecutor did here at trial, she would have had to invoke her right to silence sometime after she was advised by the court of her rights during, presumably, arraignment. And trial, she would have said, I invoke my right to remain silent, and otherwise her silence can be used against her?
Well, we only care about whether she was silent in the face of interrogation by police. So in that situation, she would have invoked, and we don't have any objection. She invoked her silence to talk.
But that's not the situation we have here, counsel. We have the prosecutor referring to her silence, asking her about it up until the date of trial.
Sure. And that's, I'm not sure the jury is going to make such a fine distinction as we are in saying, oh, that means she didn't go to the police, especially when the prosecutor made it a point to say she didn't tell her family. She cooked it up with the inmate after reading an article.
Well, how about this Nebraska case that's cited by the defendant, State versus Lofquist, where it says if you can't, if it's difficult to tell whether you're talking about pre-advisement or post-advisement silence, we're going to construe it as post-advisement silence, essentially, is what it says. Is there some reason why we shouldn't follow that?
Because there wasn't silence in the, I guess what I would say is the focus of closing argument where the DA specifically said she didn't tell someone, she didn't say this, was at the hospital. And we know that wasn't silence. And I think these other comments are really vague, that nothing was said up until the time of trial. He specifically said nothing was said to the Denver Post. Nothing was said to the family. These aren't Fifth Amendment concerns. She didn't have a right to silence to the Denver Post.
Oh, but during his cross-examination of her, the prosecution said, you didn't tell the police that SP tried to kill you. No, I didn't. So for 8 months, you held on to this story. That's referring to her talking to the police, isn't it?
Perhaps. The questions before that, I'll address the statement she did give in the hospital. So I guess it just depends on how fine we want to parse the reading of the record.
Oh, okay. If all you had in the record was the one question and answer that Judge Terry just read to you, would that be a Fifth Amendment violation?
It could be interpreted that way.
So then your argument again would be it was harmless because?
Because there was overwhelming evidence.
Yeah, he said, she said case. There was overwhelming evidence.
No, that was not a he said, she said case.
There's no question he was shot by her.
Certainly.
The question was when, right?
Her story was that he grabbed her by the hood of her sweatshirt and dragged 160 pounds of her, threw her across the room, and then with all of his strength, with his hand, choked her until she was unconscious. She had a bruise you could barely see. There was no physical evidence to corroborate her story.
She wound up in the hospital, though, right?
Because she attacked him while he was on 911. And he put the phone down, which you can hear if you listen to the 911 call. And he jumped on her head. So, yeah, he did injure her. But his arm is bleeding, and he's on the phone. And she says, you're not making a phone call, and jumps him.
Okay. Thanks. Your time is up, counsel. Thank you. Ms. Dunn, you've got, I guess, about 3 minutes and 40 seconds.
I'd like to just briefly address the second issue, which opposing counsel mentioned at the beginning, the error in saying that she had admitted after deliberation element. I think it's clear from the law that after deliberation requires an additional finding. And so, I mean, as counsel recognized, it's clearly wrong to say that it doesn't require an additional finding. I just want to point out that I don't think that the fact that she acted after deliberation was in any way conceded by defendant's argument at trial. I mean, in fact, we asked for an instruction defining for the jury that self-defense could be an instinctive, hasty, impulsive act and still be an act of self-defense. And we cited Sanchez and we cited B. Hill. So I disagree with that.
Counsel, are you aware of any Colorado case that's adopted this Nebraska case that I was just talking with your colleague about?
No, Your Honor, I'm not. I just thought that it was on point, and so I discussed it. I also want to respond to counsel's statement that that you have to invoke the Fifth Amendment in order to rely on the Doyle versus Ohio rule against impeachment with silence. And I believe that's simply incorrect. Doyle versus Ohio, the premise of it is that it's a due process violation to assure a defendant that she has the constitutional right not to come forward, not to make a full statement, and then to use that failure to come forward against her. And what it says in Doyle is, look, the silence in the wake of these warnings may be nothing more than the arrestee's exercise of these Miranda rights. Thus, every post-arrest silence is insolubly ambiguous. There's no indication in that case that there's a requirement that she invoke the right.
Doyle has been significantly eroded, though, by subsequent case law, hasn't it?
I think that substantive case law has discussed the situations where Doyle doesn't apply, but I don't think we're in that situation. I think we're in a situation where Doyle still clearly applies. And finally, I disagree that there's overwhelming evidence of guilt here. What it comes down to is whether or not Ms. Palumbo acted in self-defense, and that happened in the basement, and the two witnesses were Ms. Palumbo and Mr. Palumbo, and they gave very differing accounts of what happened. So I think Ms. Palumbo's credibility was very important to her case, and the prosecutor's impeachment went to that credibility. And if there's no further questions, I ask the court to reverse and remand for new trial.
Thank you, Ms. Dunn. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course.